Welcome to CSEE's This Compassionate Life with Bob Pyle. Bob is a Yale Forestry School graduate and Fulbright Fellow who lives in Grays River in Southwest Washington. He founded the Xerces Society, which protects wildlife through the conservation of invertebrates, and has published hundreds of essays and poems and 14 books, one of which won the John Burroughs Award for Distinguished Nature Writing.
I think I've always felt deep human connection with the rest of the natural world. That's never been in doubt. But like many another young urban environmentalist and campaigner from the 60s and 70s, I fell prey to the dichotomies that I now consider to be particularly false dichotomies, the dichotomies between the urban and the rural, the dichotomies between those who derive treasure from exploiting the earth and those who work to save the treasure of the earth. In other words, between loggers and conservationists, miners and conservationists, ranchers and conservationists, it's so easy to fall into an us and them kind of a framework. Probably at times fell prey to the idea that the natural is that which is good, that which we venerate, and that acts or manufactures and artifices or artifacts of human occupation of the land that are unpalatable and unhealthy and undesirable are not natural somehow. So that the legal term unnatural act could actually have some meaning. I've been concentrating in recent years on questioning those kinds of dichotomies and asking if they actually have any legs. And they usually don't. Most dichotomies are false dichotomies. Most things actually exist in gradients, whether it's gender, so-called wilderness, intelligence, any kind of a quantity that we seek to measure. They don't exist in on or off, like digital bytes, or positive and negative. They exist in gradients of quantity and quality. And that's absolutely true with wilderness and with countryside. So that living in a town where those little green signs that say, this family supported by timber dollars, really makes sense. Finding out where the paper that my books are printed on come from. Barry Lopez calls it the flesh of the trees, and it's absolutely right. It's the pulp of these hemlock trees being grown in monoculture plantations across the valley from here that will become the flesh of my books and the paper that we use. And it didn't take much more than living here for a while in a community of people who actually derive their livelihoods from the land still, and the land and the water, the fishermen, the farmers, and the loggers, and what's left of their cultures, to realize that some of the assumptions that I'd made and prejudices that I'd come to in the city were false and were not only unfair to them, but were unfair to me, because they gave me a myopic view of how humans fit into the rest of the natural world. What an artist can come to embrace under the sobriquet of nature writing is nothing less than everything. And consequently, though I teach classes called environmental writing, and I've done so from Tajikistan to Tasmania, and the first thing I tell the students at the beginning is this word is a complete redundancy, because I don't know and I cannot figure out anything that I can possibly write about or that you can possibly write about in my cosmos that is not part of nature, that is not part of the natural world, that is not part of the environment. What else is there besides the environment? Absolutely nothing. Now, there are people who embrace a supernature, a realm of the spirit that they don't consider to be part of the realm of nature, and I respect that, but it's beyond my comprehension. I've never felt that the natural was wanting in any way, metaphysics apart. How can anything be not part of nature? I think people get in trouble when they try to define natural in terms of the word good. I mean, you see how the mercantile world exploits us on this. Anything they want us to buy, they call natural or organic. Well, organophosphate pesticides are organic. You know, now I'm not in any way diminishing the organic foods movement, but I am saying that we're highly suggestible to the idea that somehow the natural, the organic, or whatever word you want to use, is good, and other things are not as good. We are deeply exploited by mercantile interests this way. But I think we're also befuddled by some writers and some ideologues and also a lot of very well-intentioned people who will suggest that polluted sites, Love Canal or the nuclear polluted sites in Japan or Nevada, those are not natural. What's natural is the wilderness. A dump, that's not natural. The city, dense city, that's not natural. But how could it not be so? Because all these things are products of the artifice of a species of upright hominoid ape. Now, if that upright hominoid ape isn't part of nature, then we are in deep, deep trouble. And I think that's the most dangerous idea in the world, that humans and the rest of nature somehow have a division between them. So I wonder how we can say that any given emanation of human activity on the earth is not natural, because it's all the product of this particular species of great ape. And this particular species of great ape, Homo sapiens, is evolved as part of the great parade of evolution. And we share 98% of our DNA with other species of great apes. And we are definitely a part of all the rest. If we are, in fact, not a part of nature, then that gives license and permission for all manner of enormities that we may commit against the rest of nature and ourselves. And it does, and we do. If men and women are somehow apart from the rest of nature, then all is lost in a way, because it means that we somehow can exempt ourselves and accept ourselves from dependence in both directions. There are those who think that we'll come to a time when we really can be cyborgs and we're not dependent upon green leaves and other animals. I'd hate to live in such a time. I doubt such a time could actually possibly come, because the world is far too complex to encapsulate in that manner. But in the meantime, as we continue to act as if the human economy is 9/10 of everything and all the rest is just a footnote, then we continue to diminish the base upon which we all depend. Not only our physical bodies, but our hearts and our minds and our spirits, whatever that means. And so when I teach my environmental writing classes, I'll begin the class by saying, you may write about whatever you wish, but the one thing that will distinguish your writing in this class as environmental writing is that you'll be aware that there are other species out there, and that we as a species occupy living communities, and we'll pay some attention and some obeisance to other species and to other landscapes. And that makes writing environmental writing, as far as I'm concerned. Even a person written about living in a box with no other stimuli would be environmental writing. It would just be an extremely depleted environment. One way I like to get this across, when people kind of shake their head and they wonder, what do you mean? How could that be? Is by comparing two books and two authors. One of them, very popular today, considered, many would say, a nature writer, environmental writer. His name is Michael Pollan. And of course, his first big book that most people know about was Botany of Desire. The other writer that I'd contrast with him is Jay McInerney, darling of the literary critics in New York in the 80s and the 90s, and still a popular New York writer, but considered by many sort of the ultra-urban, infra-human writer. Nobody would call him a nature writer. Now, I'd like to compare their two books, The Botany of Desire and Bright Lights, Big City. Botany of Desire, commonly on everybody's list of favorite nature books. It's about how several species of plants dramatically affected human affairs. Nobody would even question putting it on a list of important nature books. Bright Lights, Big City, oh, that's the ultra-urban book. It takes place in New York City in the 80s. But I would argue that both of them are equally nature writing. And the reason is this. If you look at Bright Lights, Big City, it's a book about geology, because most of the action takes place either on horizontal geologic strata composed of asphalt and concrete and stone, or in vertical, upright canyons composed of stone and travertine and steel. By the way, those geologic strata were laid down by a species of upright hominoid ape who derive the materials from mountains and deserts. Now, if you look at that book, it's also a book about atmospherics, because the air does flow between the East River and the Hudson River in wind. There's a lot of wind blowing through the canyons. And rainfalls from the skies. So it's an atmospherics book. It's a zoology book because it contains silverfish and rats and pigeons and a whole lot of upright hominoid apes. It's a fairly depleted fauna, but it's definitely a book of zoology. It's just that the behavior is that of this particular species of great ape instead of rabbits. Watership Down is a nature book, or is it a social book about rabbits? This is a nature book about apes. Ultimately, though, it's a botany book, just like The Botany of Desire. Botany of Desire is about how, I think, four or five species of plants dramatically affect human history. I think it's apples, tulips, cannabis, potatoes, maybe one other. Well, The action in Bright Lights Big City is driven partly by barley, yeast, and hops, because there's both a good deal of beer and whiskey in the book. It's driven by Nicotiana, because people still smoked in New York at that time. It's driven by poppies. Poppies. Because there's a lot of refined product of poppy seed in that book in the form of heroin. But it is, and of course, cannabis, one of the same plants that Michael Pollan writes about, is important to the book. But the primary action of the book is driven by one particular species of plant, which is coca, because it's mostly about a yuppie book about cocaine abuse in New York in the 80s. So it's a completely botanically driven book, and I don't see why that can logically be called any less of a nature book than The Botany of Desire. Now, this may seem absurd, but I think the logic of it completely holds up, and I think you could carry that through to absolutely any book at all.
Please read for us a favorite passage from your most recent book, Mariposa Road, and give us insight into your reverence for butterflies.
In my book, Mariposa Road, I traveled all over the country for one entire year to try to see as many different kinds of American butterflies as I could. Not just to list them, although that was the game that drove the days, but the actual intent was twofold. Part of it was to get a broad overview of the condition of butterflies in the whole continent at this time, after 40 years of involvement in their conservation. And the other one was to renew my acquaintance with all the butterflies, as many kinds as I could find, not to simply tick the rare ones, but to examine and engage with every butterfly I saw, common ones as well as the rare ones, in a kind of celebratory way that would refresh me in my engagement with this age-old love affair. So this passage takes place on the very border of Georgia and Florida. Around 4, I came to a primitive campsite on St. Mary's River, a broad, gently winding Blackwater River. Train whistles blew from the Georgia side. I had a banana for lunch and spread out the peel for bait. A bright green anole shuffled in the leaves beside an oak log covered with conchs, and then turned dark against the gray bark as if a green hairstreak butterfly became a frosted elfin before my eyes. I soaked my sore feet in the river. They looked amber in the shallows, then disappeared altogether. That truly black water, the steep, slippery slope, and the possibility of unseen alligators, and who knows what, all argued against going any deeper. But it felt so good on my hot, sweaty skin. So, of course, I stripped off and went in. Not as cold as the Colorado River a month earlier, but cold enough. And when I swam toward a bald cypress, the water looked like orange pekoe iced tea, steeped too long with too many bags. I stood on my knees in soft silt, just my head out of the water, looking up at wild pink azaleas with 4 species of enormous, elegant swallowtails dripping from them. Spicebush, pipevine, eastern tiger, and palamedes. Soft breeze and dragonflies stitched the surface as swallow-tailed kites sewed it back together. This was what I had dreamt of when I dreamt of this trip. I rose, placed my bare little fanny on a tuffet of moss, and just grinned and grinned. I've often been asked, so why butterflies? Why are they such a passion for you? Actually, I began as a young naturalist with seashells in Colorado. At 7 years old, I became utterly infatuated with mollusks. I had a collection. I typed out their scientific names on my grandmother's typewriter. I spent all of my allowance on seashells at the Denver Museum of Natural History. I even belonged to a Shell of the Month club. But Colorado was a really stupid place to be a young conchologist. And finally, I figured that out. And as I did, I was walking around the little weedy park and then out on the Highland Canal on my very first expeditions, and I began to notice these bright, flittery things. Everything that moved intrigued me. My mother showed me a cocoon in the garden when I was probably 3, and that's my first memory of interacting with something that you could call natural history. But ever since then, everything that moved intrigued me. Though I was deeply arachnophobic, it was very hard at first because spiders scared me violently. I had to get over that eventually because that was a severe impediment to butterfly study, and not to mention a social liability too when I was a kid. It was bad enough to carry a butterfly net around as a teenager, but then to be scared of spiders, that just didn't work for girls. So I got over that. But other than spiders at first, everything that moved intrigued me, and yet these little flitting parcels of color, bluish things flying around the weeds in the park, flying around the cheese weeds. Turned out they weren't really blue. They were checkered black and white, but they had hairs on their body that reflected blue in the sun. They were checkered skippers. How intriguing were they? And then on one of my first trips over to the Hainan Canal with my brother, we saw a big chocolate brown butterfly fly right in front of our faces and pause. And I saw that it was deep, dark chocolate with blueberry spots on the wings and margins like French vanilla, and it sailed in front of our faces and then off up over the dome of the hollow tree. Oh, I was beginning to be taken by butterflies. And then in school one day, my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Frost, instructed us in making a mural. We were going to make a mural for the classroom wall. And she wouldn't let me draw seashells because I was always drawing seashells. She said, "Bobby, this is Colorado. Draw something from around here." And I said, "Well, what?" And she put some magazines in front of me, and I opened one up, and there was a picture of a black velvet butterfly with red stripes on the wings. And it was so gorgeous. And I said, "This can't be real." And she said, "Oh, I think it is." And that's what I drew on the mural. It was called a Red Admiral. These days, I prefer its old English name, Red Admirable. But that's what it was. I still wasn't quite sure I believed it was real. And that fall, when I first began hunting butterflies a little bit, I was out on the canal with my friend Jack in an old barnyard. And in the late summer sun, just before sunset, a butterfly came floating down out of the trees and landed in the last rays of sunshine to bask at the base of the tree. And it was a Red Admiral. And I was absolutely taken. And from then on, I've never wavered in my love for butterflies. I mean, I'm a birder, deeply interested in mushrooms. I pay a lot of attention to the birds and to the plants and to the mosses and the slugs and everything else. Not a bit of nature is uninteresting to me, but butterflies still maintain a deep, important place in my heart and a place in most of my books. Of course, I've written books about butterflies, field guides and so on, but in my nonfiction and in my poetry and in my fiction as well, butterflies often appear. As far as the actual qualities of butterflies that would render them so attractive to me or to anyone else, it's a truism to talk about their beauty. There are a few more beautiful emanations of the natural world than the wings of butterflies. Their colors are extraordinary, and not just the brilliant blues of the morphos and the chartreuses of the birdwings, which I've had the great pleasure of working with in New Guinea and in Central America, but also the subtle colors of the satyrs and the browns and the ringlets, the soft gray and brown and ochre striations. I find those soft colors just as intriguing. And as a matter of fact, the butterfly that I've spent most time studying and writing about is a all-black butterfly of the Colorado Rockies called the Magdalena Alpine. It's the only completely black butterfly in the world. So I don't have to have fancy butterflies. In fact, beyond their beauty and their colors, there's another aspect of butterflies that I think accounts for part of my much more than infatuation with them. And that goes back to the Tangled Bank. It goes back to that very paragraph of Darwin, because Darwin and Wallace and Bates and Mueller and Beebe and all the early great explorers of the natural world who were limning the patterns of their evolution and their ecology for the past couple of centuries, all were intrigued by butterflies. And I think one of the main reasons is that their wings are a living palette of evolution. They exemplify adaptation for purposes of defense, for purposes of sexual selection, for purposes of relating to the plants that they exploit and pollinate. All of the elegant and subtle adaptations of a butterfly's life are displayed on their wings in such a way that most animals would not have such an obvious canvas for exemplifying.
You mentioned the phrase Tangled Bank in your book, The Thunder Tree, and I know you wrote a column by the same name for Orion magazine for several years. What does that phrase mean to you?
Ah, Tangled Bank, one of my favorite phrases. The first thing it conjures is its source, which is the great book, The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, whose ultimate paragraph is one of my two favorite paragraphs, if one can say such a thing, in the literature. The other one is the penultimate paragraph in Vladimir Nabokov's book, Lolita, for reasons that have to do with his magnificent linkage of butterflies in his life, the moral payoff, if you will, of the book Lolita, the ultimate linkage of landscape and life and the human heart, and the realization of Nabokov's wonderful phrase, "Does there not exist a high ridge where the mountainside of artistic imagination meets the opposite slope of scientific knowledge?" And that phrase is absolutely epitomized in the next to the last heartbreaking paragraph of Lolita. The other paragraph I so love, which actually accomplishes the same thing, the merger of art and science, is the last paragraph of The Origin of Species. Charles Darwin spent many, many years pulling together his findings from the voyage of the Beagle, from his correspondences, from his own researches, and finally publishing, and really only eventually doing so because Alfred Russel Wallace was barking at his heels with the same ideas, his grand masterpiece, The Origin of Species. And he concluded the great work by reiterating the entire thing in one crystalline paragraph that goes like this. "It is interesting to contemplate a tangled bank, clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other, and dependent upon each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws acting around us. These laws, taken in the largest sense, being growth with reproduction, inheritance, which is almost implied by reproduction, variability from the indirect and direct action of the conditions of life, and from use and disuse, a ratio of increase so high as to lead to a struggle for life, and as a consequence, to natural selection, entailing divergence of character and the extinction of less improved forms. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object of which we are capable of conceiving, namely, the production of the higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved." Now that's beautiful literature. It's elegant, graceful language, but it also takes one of the most important ideas ever generated at the same time in the minds of Darwin and Wallace and crystallizes it and puts it together in these words. Well, now that particular idea, the whole idea of natural selection, to me is the first cause. It is the fundament of life on Earth. And the moment of its realization is one of the great moments in human evolution itself. But beyond that, that's not why I chose that title, The Tangled Bank, for my column. Not because it was the big idea, though it's a great idea, but it's because of the intrigue that Darwin places before us by the beginning of that paragraph. It is interesting to contemplate a tangled bank. And from looking at a tangled bank of vegetation, he then goes on in this glorious paragraph to recapitulate everything he's learned. And it's most of what we need to know about life is right there in that paragraph. But he does it by looking at this bank. And so it occurred to me, that's what I'm trying to do all the time. Walk down the road, walk down the path, look into the tangled bank and see what's going on. And so it's just a synonym for intrigue and for the childlike indulgence of curiosity. What's in there? What's happening? Who's crawling around in there? And what are the consequences? And what's it going to lead to? In the words of the great Alaska once trapper, then poet, John Haynes, What Will We Find Today? I gave a graduation talk at a Waldorf school, and I didn't try to soft pedal it for the students that hearts are hurting all over the world and that the heart of the world itself is hemorrhaging. It's futile not to recognize that. And yet that need not block one at any given moment, unless one is under extreme duress oneself, from taking the succor and the pleasure and the relief and the refreshment that the world has to offer.